Listen and stream the all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5 for the only talk that matter.
As I said to you all earlier on, from this morning, we begin a series of discussions, all commemoration of International Women's Day, which will be celebrated on Wednesday. We'll be speaking to several women in different fields, we'll be delving into some of the topics, some of the issues that affect them. Joining us this morning, she's no stranger to the program. She's been here on numerous occasions speaking to us about issues coming out of the Senate, about legal issues, political issues. This morning, we speak to her on, related to several of those, but on a different footing. Let's welcome to our program Opposition Senator Attorney at Law, Jayanti Lakshmi-Dayal. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Satish. Thank you once again for having me, and good morning to all your listeners.
It's nice to have you here this morning as we kick off a week of discussions on women. And of course, this week, is the world is going to observe International Women's Day, and I thought it fitting that we have a lot of discussions this week about women, where women are, the achievements they've made, and highlight some of the women amongst us who've made stellar contributions, who are shining examples to others, some of the challenges. And it's a lot of things that we can discuss and we're going to discuss. You are no stranger to the national landscape. Your professional prowess is well known, as well as your political contributions in the Senate and everything else. Front page news many times. So it's not as if you are somebody who we don't know. But do we really know about you? And the reason why I'm asking that question is today on the program, we're not necessarily going to be delving too much into the political
the element.
We'll get into some of those as well. But we want to find out about you, Jayanti Lakshmi-Dayal, some of who you really are, where you came from, some of your challenges, some of your successes, some of your disappointments. As we continue with our discussion, I know that you're a mother, and we'll be getting into all of those. Let's begin delving deep into Jayanti Lakshmi-Dayal. Tell us a bit about yourself, the early years, your schooling, your family, and some of those. Let's start our discussion there.
Well, I describe myself to people as a real South girl. I was born in San Fernando. I've lived all my life, except for brief periods when I attended university and so on. I've lived all my life in San Fernando. I come from, I'm very blessed to be that second generation of women who were able to get an education. So I actually come from a family where both my parents are also attorneys. And so I grew up in that sort of household. But I would say my parents, it sounds, when people hear that, eyebrows raise and they think very, you know, affluent and privileged life. And I do admit I've led a very privileged life. I've had a lot of privileges in terms of education and otherwise. But I would say I grew up always being reminded to be humble and to work hard, and always being reminded of where I come from. I was raised in a Presbyterian home. My father comes from a Hindu background, but we were raised as Presbyterian, and that was a very big part of our upbringing. Church and everything surrounding church was always very important to us. And like normal, I guess, teenagers and then young adults, I sort of, you know, veered off that route for a little bit as I went away to university and all of that. But I think I've become a lot more grounded in that respect in the last maybe 10 years, and more so since I became a mom, because I'm following in the footsteps of my parents and trying to raise my daughter in a similar fashion. I went to a small school in San Fernando, primary school, which no longer exists, but it was a private school, which wasn't very common in those days. My grandfather, who I actually grew up very close with, I grew up a lot with having a working mom and a working dad. I grew up a lot with my mom's parents. And my grandfather was a retired school supervisor. So someone that he had known in the teaching profession had started this very small school, very close to where they live. And because I grew up and spent a lot of time there, my cousins and I, we all went to that school. I went on from there to attend Napa Girls High School. Something that I still feel awkward mentioning, but people always ask me why I don't mention it, is that I won a national scholarship at NAPS. And you would have seen in the news, NAPS actually got the most scholarships last year. That's been a trend. I think since the year that I rose A-levels, which is what, 2001, it was a similar situation. I would credit NAPS with a lot of my grounding and my development. By the time you get to university, I think you sort of have a work ethic developed. You sort of have a kind of outlook on life, because those formative years between the years of 11 and 18, I think they really turn you into, they really give you those that footing, that foundation. I think high school is just so important in that respect. And I was really fortunate that NAPS was, and I think still is, an institution that forces you to, it's not all a bed of roses. There were some rough moments, there are things you don't like about a school like that, that's sometimes a bit too stringent in certain ways, and you feel confined, and you feel that maybe some of the rules are a bit outdated, and you perhaps would prefer to have a more realistic view of the world. A lot of people think that when you attend schools like that, you grow up in a bit of a bubble. And that's true. I did grow up in a bit of a bubble, but I was grateful for that bubble, because within that bubble, I think I sort of developed a lot of the there were a lot of concepts that were embedded in me at that age that have carried me through life.
Mm.
I went on to university. I studied law. A lot of people ask me as well if I studied law by choice, if it was because of my parents, obviously. I was influenced a lot to pursue that career. And I mean, it's not that I didn't want it and I wasn't interested in it. I always grew up very interested in it, perhaps because I grew up around it. But I also had other interests, which I pursue in my own time, such as like interior decorating. I always wanted to be an interior decorator. And so that's sort of like a hobby for me, doing things like that. And yeah, I started off again. I've modeled my life a lot after my parents. So I entered the public service, being a former, having won a scholarship, you have mandatory service as well. So I entered the public service. I worked there for about 9 years until I joined the law firm of Mr. Ram Logan. And I think that is where I got a lot of exposure to the mix of law and politics. And but I was always very interested in politics. I remember Form 2 and so on, when we had the 1995 general election, I would make my dad carry me to political meetings in San Fernando on Sutton Street corner. In those days, you had a tent or a corner of a street. It wasn't like what we see now in political rallies. And, you know, they would have political meetings on literally under the streetlight. And I was so interested in those things. And I was always very keen and eager to follow politics and national affairs and all of that. So it has led me to where I am now. On a personal level, I am a mom. I have a 6-year-old daughter. I'm divorced. So I'm a single mom. That's, again, something that people don't like to talk about, but I have no problem talking about it. It's part of life. And I think it makes me understand the struggles of, you know, that people go through. And I have a good relationship with my ex-husband. We raise our daughter. We don't have those issues. We've had a very mature approach to trying to make the best of the situation. Marriages fall apart. I think people who are in public life tend to feel embarrassed and ashamed to discuss those things. I don't feel like we should shame people for those things. That's one of the issues that I hope, as for both men and women, that I hope as we mature as a society, we'll move away from that sort of mindset. But we try our best to be good parents. And I think that's the most important thing. And yeah, that's me. I try to balance. Now I tell people I have 3 jobs, being a mom, being in politics, and my law practice. So I try to balance my 3 jobs as best as I could. And I got into politics because I felt that it's so easy to complain about the things we don't like about our country, but it's a lot harder to actually step up and try to propose solutions. And one of the things, as much as I speak out on what is wrong, I always try to focus on what could be done better. So in every single one of my Senate contributions, if I have to critique a piece of legislation, for example, I will say this can't work because of this. This ought not, you know, the government shouldn't have done it this way, or they've taken too long to do this, et cetera, et cetera. But I always end off with trying to say, look, if you really want to solve this problem, this is the way it should go. And that's my approach to politics, because I think that that's the type of conversation we need to be having at this point in time in order to face a lot of the challenges. And that's the underlying philosophy that I have in life, and not just in politics. I think in life, it's important if you're speaking to friends, family, whatever. It's very easy to find fault and critique. It's a lot harder to put forward solutions, and you have to do a mix of both if you want to really make a difference. So that's sort of the approach that I have.
Let's talk a bit about, you admitted that you came from what many people will describe as a very sheltered upbringing, but getting into the world of work when it comes to law exposes you to the underbelly of the beast, and you get to see things that probably might have been very shocking to you based on your upbringing. Let's talk about some of those, and in particular, some of the challenges that you saw some of the nation's women having to confront.
So definitely, when I was in law school, I did what we call in-service training, which is where you sort of get to experiment in the world of work. And I fell in love with criminal law and prosecuting, because I did a little stint at the office of the DPP. So when I graduated, I was just like, I was obsessed with getting back in there and becoming a prosecutor. But it really did open my eyes, because that is where basically you deal for the entire day with police, with criminals, with court, the criminal justice system. I remember the first time I saw somebody being brought into the court in handcuffs, and my stomach did about, you know, like a somersault. it shook me. It sounds simple, but when you see it in real life, when you come from, you know, a girl like me who, I'm being very honest with you, the first time my parents allowed me to take a taxi was when I went to Cave Hill, and I had no vehicles, so I had no choice, but I was very, very, very sheltered. And so I had to understand now that, okay, and see these things. You see it on TV, but you never see it in real life. And I did, and I'm glad you asked, because it really opened my eyes to the challenges that women face in this country. I never knew how much, before that, before getting into the world of work, I never knew how much women suffered in silence in terms of abuse. I never realized, of course, I understood that there was domestic violence taking place and all that. I, you know, within my family and circles and society, of course, it exists. I'm not saying it doesn't exist in the world that I come from, but the extent of it, I think I saw a lot more of it. I found a lot more about the level of sexual abuse and how much sexual abuse women were subjected to in this country. I also saw firsthand the type of situations that women place themselves in sometimes because out of necessity and desperation. And that is one thing that really, I think I didn't understand before. I didn't know before how women ended up in abusive relationships, even exposing their children to situations that were dangerous and abusive, simply out of a need for survival. Women who, this is a very typical case that I would see and people that I would encounter, and even now in politics, when, of course, you're out there on the ground and reaching out to people, it's very typical, for example, to find women who come from homes with, you know, it's not the best in terms of financially, perhaps there's alcoholism, there's abuse, etc. And so women find themselves in relationships at a very young age. We still have a problem in this country where we do not talk about sex education, and we do not talk about contraception, and we do not educate our women, especially in rural areas, enough. And so we have a high rate of unplanned pregnancies. And these unplanned pregnancies often lead to people being in relationships that they're not prepared for. And then you end up those relationships sometimes end, and then you end up with, because you're financially dependent on that person, or, you know, sometimes in a lot of cases, one party is not honoring the commitment to the child that they ought to. And so you find women moving on into another relationship and entering into another relationship simply because that relationship helps put food on the table, clothes on your back, and a roof over your head. And it's a cycle, and it goes on and on. And it's a cycle that has a lot of abuse. It's a cycle that always has a negative, I think, psychological effect. I'm not saying all the time. There are a lot of people who have second and third marriages and whatever, and it works out well for them. But in a lot of cases where these relationships come up as a result of necessity, there are a lot of problems. And women tend, in this country, I find, to, because we don't accommodate, for example, to a large extent, you know, working from home and flexible hours and childcare, proper childcare in workplaces and so on, you find that women tend to stay at home once their children are involved and they don't have that help and that assistance. And that will oftentimes result in the man being the breadwinner in the family, and of course the woman becoming dependent and therefore having to settle or accept a certain, less than they deserve in some relationships. And that is something that I didn't understand, how much the social safety net was important in our country. And that is something that I didn't understand growing up, but I understood when I went into the world of work, because that social safety net is what could help take a lot of people out of that cycle. Of course, you have people that abuse the social safety net as well. But you really want to ensure that those who need it get it. And you want to have a situation where we don't have generations of children growing up under similar circumstances, whereby a lack of access to financial resources results in less education than they deserve, less opportunities than they deserve, less training opportunities, job opportunities, and less less options in terms of what you want to do with your life. There are still people and families in this country that believe that there are some girls, when you finish school, is, you know, university is not ready for you. You try to become, you know, if you want to work, yes, but you work in what I would call mediocre, clerical, that type of, not exploiting the full potential that women may have. And of course, getting married, because that's still seen as an accomplishment in a certain way. It's expected, marriage and having children. And there's nothing wrong with wanting those things for yourself, but it ought not to be imposed, and it ought not to be taught to our girls, I think, that is what you have to do. It is something that if you wish to do, you should do it. Mm. But it's not something should have to do, because again, you want to have our women and our girls making the right choices and having understanding what healthy relationships look like and getting into those relationships. And those things usually are easier to do if you have access to education and you have access to information and you are brought up in a way where you're allowed to flourish, I would say, in some respects.
I find the discussion to be very interesting. Your perspective is able to cross the boundaries, and your perspective is able to analyze and appreciate what people are going through simply because you are able to look at it from both inside and out, as a representative, as somebody who's passionate about the field of law. And law in itself brings about making sure that people, their rights are respected and all of those various things. But the statistics are suggesting, and the last time we had, that women in this country are educating themselves more and yep. are marrying later, if they're marrying at all. That's not necessarily just a trend here at home. It's an international trend. And I'm sure that the women's rights movement and a lot of what some girls have seen at home, it's forced them into this self-reliance mode, in that, listen, I need to take care of myself. There are many people who have daughters and tell their children, you have to be able to take care of yourself first so that you wouldn't have to depend on anyone and that you don't put yourself in some of these circumstances that unfortunately people find themselves in. Financial abuse is one thing. Emotional abuse and psychological abuse is a totally different thing. We've been seeing some trends, and we'll need to take a couple messages in a while and then we'll open the phone lines. We've been seeing some trends, though, that suggest, to me at least, that our women are not necessarily on the back foot as much as they were at one point in time.
Definitely not. I think the UE, the last time I saw it, I think the only faculty in UE that still had a slight in terms of men, more men were the engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely women are taking the lead. That also, however, has a lot of other issues coming out of it, because as women forge our way forward, and yes, you're right, the generation of my parents, for example, pushed our daughters. Every woman in my generation, my family, is a professional. You know, lawyers, doctors, teachers, all of my friends are successful. All of my friends who I went to high school with are very successful accountants, businesswomen, all of that. But then that raises the question now where women are forging ahead, if that poses a challenge in terms of personal relationships and men being able to, because you see, and I my leader, Mrs. Prasad Bisesso, who of course understands this all too well, spoke on Saturday at a function, and she mentioned that proverb that says, you know, women hold up half the sky. And she said, but who holds up the other half? It's the men. So we're supposed to be partners and doing this thing hand in hand. But when women are now pushing forward and the whole dynamic is changing so that women are no longer the homemakers while men are the breadwinners, and we are out there, as you say, becoming financially independent, we're able to support ourselves, etc., are the men evolving alongside us so that they are now picking up the half of the sky that is home, childcare, and all of those things? And are they able to cope with the new modern day educated, financially independent woman? Because that in itself poses quite a bit of challenges, not just in terms of finding a partner, but navigating the relationship.
I understand exactly what you're saying, because for some strange reason, these podcasts that happen in the US or wherever else, there are some that focus greatly on relationships and how the balances have been skewed, and there's a discussion taking place where feminism is totally different to women's equal rights, and that when you marry both of them, what you have now is that initially the battle for women's rights was to present an equal playing field. And yeah. Now, and one of the positions put forward is that feminism is teaching women that they don't need a man, they don't need a home, they don't need a family, they don't need children. All they need is a career and to be successful. And that is what will mean that, you know, they've made it in life. And the discussions are showing that there is documented evidence to show that When you become 50 or 60 and you realize to yourself that you're alone, your career brings you only so much comfort. Are young women today being told the wrong message, that they don't need a family, they don't need a husband, they don't need those comforts that come with a stable relationship? Once you have a job, once you have a career, once you have an education, you've made it. Do you think
So I would tell you this, in life, something that my mom would have said to me that stayed with me a lot was that no one can take your education away from you. Relationships could come and go and they could end. Look at me, I'm divorced, right? There might have been a time when I thought of having a husband and having a family and getting married and having the dream wedding and all that was part of what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of what I wasn't taught that I shouldn't want those things, but I was also taught that before those things happen, you put yourself in a position that those things don't make or break you. And perhaps that's the reason why I was able to navigate that little hiccup in my life quite well, I think. So I think the message ought not to be that this is better than that. It's not that having a family and being a mother and being a wife is better than having a career. It's not that having a career is better than being a mom. I would give up my career in the morning, politics and law, if it meant that I would be a better mother. In fact, I've made several sacrifices professionally since becoming a mother in terms of my law practice so that I could have time to dedicate to my child. But you see, at the end of the day, it was my choice. And I believe the message is that you must do what makes you happy. There's nothing wrong with a woman deciding she wants to be a stay-at-home mom if she feels she has a stable enough relationship that she doesn't need to earn that income for herself, because she feels confident and stable enough in the marriage that she's in or whatever relationship she's in that she can do so. Why, for example, people like myself and perhaps women my age, I'm 40, so we're looking at around that age group, we may have pushed ourselves academically, I think, it's because our mothers were sort of the first generation to start breaking that barrier of getting an education. My mom always told me that she was one of the few girls from her form six class or whatever who went on to in a profession. You had people more, a lot of women at that time going into like teaching and so on, but law wasn't really that common, right? So there were very few female attorneys going out there and all that. It sort of started around that time. We're looking at the 70s and so on. And so they still had those challenges in terms of dealing with the traditions and so on, and the expectations of women. And so for them, growing up their daughters, it was a push towards, look, get your education, because this is how things, you know, women have seen so much hardship. And you understand, when you're coming out of hardship, right, it's like you try to overcompensate.
Right.
It's like you are so determined to not see another generation go through what we went through. My grandmother planted rice on my paternal side. She used to plant rice. She used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and fry chana and nuts. And when she'd take up my dad and siblings to school, she used to sell outside of the school. And in the evening, she used to wash bottles in a bottle factory. And that's how she educated her five children. So that generation of women wanted to push education so hard. I would tell you, forget about getting married and having 5 and 6 and 7 and 10 children and push yourself with education, because they struggle so hard, you know. Now where you have women who are like myself in a better place, yes, we had our education, but we know what the options are. We know the options that are available to us and we choose. And I think that the world is evolving in such a way now that, look, you know, women, who would have thought in the days of my grandmother that a woman could open a business and open a small business on her own and thrive and do something that she loves? Who would have thought that a woman could, if she loves to bake? My grandmother was the best cook ever, like ever in life. If my grandmother make a dosi roti and chana and aloo for you, you lick your fingers. But my grandmother probably never thought that, you know, she would could open a roti shop and have an empire of roti shops. But I'm positive that she had the talent to do it. Women now will understand that, listen, I could raise my family, and instead of going into a profession where I'm required to be on the 8-to-4 grind and working late hours and et cetera, I'll open a business. I'll use my talent. I'll use my baking skills and open a coffee shop and do something that allows me to balance my life. So our thinking, our opportunities, what we know to be possible, it's all changing. But at the end of the day, my message to girls, and I do a lot of this in terms of talking to girls and so on, is do what you love and do what makes you happy. But always, at the end of the day, protect yourself. Understand the challenges. Look, money, as people like to say, love important, but money important, huh? Because, you know, it's difficult for somebody to take away your success. It's difficult for somebody to take away your business, your education, whatever you build for yourself. But relationships fall apart from time to time, and you want to have that fallback position if you're there. And I think that is the message that I wish all girls understood. So there's nothing wrong with wanting to make concessions professionally, to be a mom, to be a wife, to be a good wife and a good mother and all of that. You choose your path in life. but you always ensure that your survival is something that you have at the forefront of your mind.
We need to take a couple quick messages, and when we get back, we'll open our phone lines on 627-3223, 625-2257. Our special guest kickstarting this week of discussions on women, women's rights, women's issues. Opposition Senator, Attorney at Law Jayanti Lakshmidiyal. Stay with us.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
Welcome back. Our special guest, Opposition Senator, Attorney at Law Jayanti Lakshmidiyal. We'll be discussing women's issues. Let's take some of your calls. 627-3223, 625-2257. Hello, good morning.
A pleasant good morning once more, Satish. A pleasant good morning, Senator. Senator, because of the person who you are, and Satish, permit me, I am going to focus on children, girls actually. Senator, you will recall that at one time the Muslim and the Hindu Marriage Act allowed children, young girls, to get married with parental consent and so on. That has changed, but what we have noticed is that many 15-year-old, 14-year-old, 16-year-old are becoming pregnant. Do you view that as, and sometimes the parents support it and so on, but nobody has ever been charged in this country with regard to that. Do you view it as a violation against the child, or do you think that we should return to that era when with parental consent they could get married to save the image of the child and so on? I thank you. Enjoy.
Thank you for your call.
Do you want me to answer now? You want to continue taking
Answer. Go ahead.
So I don't, my personal view, and this is not the view of any political party or any organization or anything like that, not even my own perhaps religious background. This is just my personal view, right? So let me premise this on that. My view is that marriage ought not to take place to save anybody's image. I don't believe that the image of a woman, a girl or whatever, should be tarnished because of a pregnancy. I think that we have to stop stereotyping girls who become pregnant as bad girls. And I just want to say for the record that I've never heard anybody describe a boy who impregnates a 16 or 17 year old girl, regardless of his age, whether he's a child or an adult, as a bad boy or a bad man. So, you know, that stigma certainly doesn't follow the man throughout his life. And so I don't support, for example, parents marrying off their daughters because they become pregnant. Does it provide a stable home environment for the child that's coming into the world? Maybe. Maybe if they're in love and they are ready to do that. I actually have a friend who, he and his girlfriend were quite young when they got pregnant and got married and whatever. And, they're still together now, 3 children later, very happily married. They grew together as a couple, but they were actually in love and I think wanted to be together as opposed to some, you know, just something that happened that neither of them were ready for and neither of them really understood if they wanted to be together. So marriage is not the answer to pregnancy, right? That's the first thing. Those types of situations where people are forced into marriage or married to, as you say, to save the reputation and just for shame's sake, could often lead to bad marriages, abuse, infidelity, things like that. That is not a good environment for a child to grow up in any event.
Yeah.
I feel that a child in a single parent home that is a happy home is better off than a child in a two-parent home that is unhappy, you know, that has abuse and so on, infidelity and all of that going on in it, right? So that's just my personal view on it. With respect to people being charged, we've had the laws change. The law with respect to girls under 16 and girls under 14 has been on our statute books. I have prosecuted matters like that. However, of course, the challenge being sometimes, again, because of shame and whatnot, getting evidence to put before the court. I would like to see more people prosecuted, particularly where it involves men who are in positions of power, you know, in terms of their age, etc., being involved with girls. The age is now 18 years old. Anything below that, really, it's a crime. And if it's the law, it should be enforced. there are challenges, as I said before, but part of what would get rid of that challenge, as I said, is removing that stigma. Mm. If girls felt comfortable enough to speak about the fact that, look, I ended up being wooed by this individual, he was 10 years older than me, etc., and come to court or speak to the police, etc., we would have more of we would have more convictions in that respect. But it's a stigma that I think prevents that from happening.
Let's take another call. Hello, good morning.
Good morning to all, and happy International Women's Day to all. Senator, it's always a pleasure to listen to you. Good topic this morning. I would say women have changed a lot for themselves in a positive way. Gone are the days, mostly from the Hindu home, you were forced into a marriage. And today it's not like that for most of the young women. They built a career of their own. They might meet a young man and maybe have a child or two and then get married. And I think, you know, it's a good way of doing things like that, not to be forced into a marriage. I would say I came from a really old-fashioned Hindu home, but my parents, they were very loving to their children, especially girls. I was introduced to my husband, but I had a say in the marriage. And we mm-hmm. corresponded for a year as he was in London. I was here in Trinidad. And then he came and we got married and went to England. And I would say it was really a lovely marriage. I have two grown children and I'm a grandmother. And I mm-hmm. know what it is like to be a happy wife and mother. And I hope that women will stand up for their rights and not to be battered by men. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. A brief comment. Liz is next.
Yeah, I love hearing stories like that. I think that's, you know, the way it ought to be.
Yeah. We need to head up to the news, but I'm sure that we're going to have you for a couple minutes after 8. And a lot of people want to get in on the program, so we'll be taking more of your calls when we get back after the 8 o'clock news. And there are a couple other things that I want to talk to you about as we pick apart, for want of a different term, the life of women in Trinidad and Tobago with our special guest here this morning, bringing all different kinds of perspectives to the discussion, opposition senator and attorney at law, Jayanti Lajmadial.
This is the Morning Rumble with Satish Mahabir.
3 minutes after 8 for the final hour of our show. Our special guest this morning, kickstarting our week of discussions focusing on women in Trinidad and Tobago, opposition senator, attorney at law, Jayanti Lajmadial. Let's take a couple of your calls as we begin this session. Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning, Satish.
Good morning to
you. You know, more and more I've observed women are becoming more empowered and more educated and are literally rising within the society. I stand up in front sometimes when I pass in front of the gate to the university, the West Indies, and I take a mental observation of the people coming and going, and I find invariably, basically, and there's not a statistical data, but 3 out of 4 persons entering that gate are women, you know. 3 out of 4, and that is a damning condemnation of men on the whole, on our place in society, and how it's being taken over by women, and it's a good thing. I forget my manners, but Senator Lajmadial, good morning to you, Madam Senator.
Good morning.
Madam Senator, I have a question. As I said before, women are under attack partly because of their change in status within our society, the change of the role that they play within society. More and more the question is being asked, who is the best man for the job? And the answer to that question invariably comes, the best man for the job is a woman. Mm. That puts women in a target position. Now, this may segue into your participation into a recent Joint Select Committee hearing. What is your position on lethal and non-lethal weapons for women in terms of their being able to protect themselves in a society that is ultra-violent and riddled with crime? What is your position on that, madam? I'd like to hear your answer. Thank you.
Well, I think that, okay, so obviously, lethal weapons, firearms, we have to control and ensure that persons, and even non-lethal weapons, ensure that persons who have possession of those weapons are fit to have them. However, given the scourge of crime that we are experiencing, I see no difficulty with having a proper system in place to vet both men and women to have lethal and non-lethal weapons. I believe that particularly people with cash-intensive businesses, for example, would be easy targets for robbery and violence, which is, you know, the violence comes as part of the robbery and so on, and so they would want to protect themselves. We have also seen, unfortunately, a rise in, I don't know if it's a rise, if it's just we talk about it more, if it's becoming more heinous in terms of sexual violence against women, as well as the domestic type of incidents occurring where it results in death, and women, if armed with non-lethal weapons like pepper spray and so on, maybe in a position to protect themselves. As you know, there was a big discussion about women having to use transportation late at night, etc., and those things giving some sort of comfort to them and perhaps giving them a fighting chance that they could defend themselves. So I don't have a difficulty with it. I believe that once a proper system is in place to vet persons and to ensure that they are fit to hold weapons like that, then there's no, you know, I don't see a problem with it at all. In fact, I've advocated very strongly for it. This is not something unique to Trinidad and Tobago. They have it all over the world. There are, of course, instances where it could be misused. But you know what? So could a kitchen knife. We're going to ban kitchen knives. Tell people they're not, you know, we can't have kitchen knives being sold because people could use it to commit a crime. Cutlass, anything could become a weapon. You know, a bilna could be a weapon.
It has been already in the past.
You know, right? And who never get licked with a dabbler growing up? So you understand that anything could be a weapon. So I don't subscribe to the argument whatsoever that we should ban things and not allow them to be in the possession of people simply because they could be misused. Anything could be misused. So I would strongly advocate, given the circumstances that we are living in right now in our country, particularly that we do have and we make available non-lethal weapons to everybody, not just to women, yeah, but to all persons who may feel they want to protect themselves by that means.
Let's take another call. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from Bukhari. Good morning.
Okay, Bukhari, you need to speak up. We could barely hear you.
Yeah. I said good morning, and good morning to the learned Atuni.
Good morning.
I have two little questions here for them. Mature woman and career woman, how do you get married? I've worked in the service for many, many years, and you'll hear like the 04, 05 says, I don't want a husband and I want a child. And they passed the age of 40 and 50. And we had a little joke in the office one day. And I said, when you pass 40 or 50, you don't choose, you take what you get. So all the girls and them and the women in my own, they said, Mr. Mom, what are you talking about? I said, well, when you're 20, when you're married at an early age, you could pick and choose which husband you want or which wife you want and all these sorts of things. But when you're over 40, you take what you get. And a few of them agree with me, a few of them disagree. But the 90% of the career woman always say that they want a child. They're not interested in a husband. I don't know why. I don't know if you are meddling with all your women folks and all these sorts of things. Because we put the two persons. Look at Hazel Ward and Marsha Henville. Look at the age they got married or they got husband or whatsoever. And look what eventually happens at the end. But I am saying I believe in early marriage, although I never married in my life. I have wife, but never married. Yes. So I am saying, yes. I think if I did smart enough like how I am now, I would have do like all my brothers and sisters and get married by 2022 maximum. But that's how life is. We cannot study the past. We have to study the future. I thank you ever so much. I don't know if you can answer that question here for me about career woman. If they really only want a child or really want a husband.
Sorry, thank you so much. I think you dealt in great detail with that this morning in explaining how the trends have changed and how the perspectives of people have changed. I don't know if you want to repeat it quickly or if there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, I would just say that I don't think anybody should, no matter what age they get to, should just accept what you get. And I don't, I mean, if there, yes, maybe perhaps now women are more vocal about saying, well, I would like to become a mother, but I don't necessarily need to have a husband. Because again, in the past, when in generations gone by, that just simply wasn't an option. It was because you weren't financially independent and able to raise a child. Now that you have the ability, perhaps they feel confident enough to vocalize those things and to say that that's what they want. I don't think that anybody should accept marriage just because, you know, whether it's early or it's late. And I do believe that that setting of a timeline or an expiry date for women in terms of having getting a husband and those things, that is very outdated thinking. And again, I would advocate, do what makes you happy. You know,
yeah,
whether it is your career, your being a wife, mother, whatever it is, or a combination of all three, and do whatever makes you happy.
You see, one of the elements that I find very interesting in discussions like these are the purists in their views, who believe that there is a set way to do things, and any deviation from that is an abomination, it's sacrilege, and all of these kind of things. And I've become a firm believer in, because of things that have happened in my life, that nothing happens before its time. And many,
agreed,
many times when it happens, it's not within the social construct of what some people may seem to think is acceptable. But that's just the way life is, because we plan as humans as if we live forever and if we have everything the way we want it to get done. But sometimes there's a plan that's outside of ours that when it falls into place, you realize to yourself that had things gone the way you wanted them to go, you might not necessarily have been as happy as you are today. That's for sure. We need to take a couple more calls, but there's something that I have to get your opinion on a little later on. Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Atish. Good morning, Shananta Viva. Good morning, Miss Jayanti Lakshmijal there. And this is calling from Arima. Ma'am, since you have come in this public domain, I admire you as a relatively young woman professionally in your personal life and now politically. But I have a question for you. And I think, I don't know how relevant it is, but in this day, I think it is. Do you think that we have enough legislation against negligent parents, especially single mothers who have been left wanting in protecting their children from being taken advantage of, especially young girl children, right? I'll give you an example. There is talk around, and not all taxi drivers or maxi drivers are bad, but you hear cases where maxi drivers give free drops. You know, and you know, the rake references chicken and chip girls and all these sort of things, but it all comes under that. Sometimes the parents have knowledge of this, and when something happens and goes awry, you know, then you hear all that conversation. So one wonders if there is enough legislation to bring these parents, especially single mothers, to account when things go wrong in the children. I'll listen off it. Thank you very much.
Well, my first question is, I wonder why the question is phrased as especially single mothers. Is there some reason why a single mother is more responsible for what the child does than the father? If you're a single mother and you are raising a child on your own, and obviously, perhaps as a single mother, you also have a lot of responsibilities financially, and therefore you have to work. So you're balancing working and raising children. You're not. It's not possible for anybody, even for housewives, to watch your children, 24 hours a day and to know what they're doing. So this is part of the problem. Why do we believe that a single mother supposed to take up the slack? Where is the father? That's a question I would want to know. Why don't we charge the father? Who walked out, you're asking about, and of course this is ridiculous and I'm being, facetious here. But what about the father who perhaps walked away and doesn't visit his daughter, doesn't spend time teaching his daughter about male-female relationships, doesn't give enough financial support to the family, and therefore has the mother of the children now, having to devote herself and work two jobs in order to make ends meet and can't devote the time that the children, you know, require from her, et cetera, to the home. Why do we have legislation to charge the fathers? The point of the matter is having children is a two-person job. That otherwise we would be like, those animals that I can't think of them off the top of my head, but there are some animals that don't need to mate in order to have to produce young. We are not like that. It takes two people, all right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if a parent is aware of a child below the age of 18 years old being sexually active and they fail to report it, they could be charged. So the fact of us not having legislation, I hear this all the time. Why we don't have more legislation for the death penalty? You have a law for that already, you know. Why we don't have legislation for this? Why we don't have legislation for that? We need a law for this, we need a law for that. The law there. It's whether or not people can enforce the law.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, but ask yourself a question. We have to look at the bigger picture here. If a person, a woman, a single mother suspects, for example, that her daughter may be involved sexually with a man, whether it's a maxi driver, a taxi driver, whatever it is, any man, or even a boy in a school, whatever it is, would arresting her and charging her solve the problem? Or do we need to tackle the root cause of the problem? Do we need to deal more with girls and their self-esteem? Do we need to... I spoke about this years ago, maybe 2 years ago in the Senate, that we tend to, every time a girl goes missing in this country and they put out the thing she's missing, and then they put TTPS will issue something saying, well, you know, she was found safe and returned to her family. You read the comments that people in this country say, and I wonder sometimes if they themselves don't have daughters and know, as my mother used to say, what a meteor and pass here, that could be your child. And everything is, she going, she want this, she going to look for man, she da-da-da-da-da, that's what them girl is, it's close clip, all those old time things that we say about these girls, right? At the end of the day, do you know the situation that those girls are growing up in at home? Do you know that the kind of poverty that they're experiencing, that they have probably never had something nice in their life, new clothes, that they grew up their entire life wearing hand-me-downs and donations and so on from people? And if it is that a man comes into their life and says, listen, I can take you out, whether it's KFC or whatever it is, I will take you somewhere and let's have a nice dinner or let's go for lunch somewhere. I'll let me buy you that nice new pair of shoes that you're looking at when you've never had new shoes in your life. There are social issues underlying the behavior of children when it comes to sexuality. And this, again, it applies to both boys and girls, but of course we focus a lot on the girls. Because if a single mother has a 16-year-old son who's involved with a woman, a girl or whatever, we don't have a problem with that, you know. We think, well, partner get through. Well, you know, that's what we think of.
And
that's a problem that we have.
No, you're raising an important, and it ties back into the stigma. And you're saying that, I'm hearing in my mind people who have actually said, well, your son can't get pregnant and bring a belly home for you. That's the justification. Yeah. That people use when they have that discussion. It's 18 minutes after 8, and I know that I don't have you for much longer again this morning because you do have very busy days. But there are some things, when we were putting this week together, we wanted to focus a lot on some of the legislation that we have, some that we don't have, our laws, our strength, our women. This nation has been involved, and it would be remiss of me not to speak to you about it, because that's one of the focuses that we're going to have for this entire week. There's raging discussion in the country now about human trafficking and prostitution. And I definitely want your comments on the allegations swirling around, the lack of action. If you think that there's enough going on, we need more. Human trafficking has been with us, allegations of human trafficking, for a very long period of time. Prostitution probably even before that, to the point where when we had the discussion last week, I lamented that everybody know where these brothels are, except apparently the police. We've heard the horror stories, they're blazoned on the front page of the newspapers, and yet still we don't see the kind of crackdown that I think should accompany that kind of information in the public domain. Somebody like yourself, who I'm assuming is very concerned or aware of all of these discussions taking place, what's your view on how this nation is handling, has handled, or intends to handle the issues of human trafficking and prostitution?
Right. Well, I think firstly, let's distinguish between human trafficking and prostitution. I read an article by Martin Daly yesterday where he touched on that issue. Prostitution is sometimes referred to as the oldest profession in the world. Women have for, you know, centuries resorted to prostitution, again, as a form of survival. We all know that prostitution happens in Trinidad and Tobago, and therefore, it's something that, of course, it's illegal, but whether or not it's acceptable, quote unquote, and treated in a way that, you know, people don't really, we all know the spots as well. It's not even just the brothels. We know the street corners. For, you know, for since I was young, we know people talk about the spots that you could go to. Are we doing enough? I don't think we are, because again, how do you solve a problem like prostitution? Do you throw the women in prison? Do you pick them up off the street and put them in prison for trying to sell sex as a way of survival?
Let me
tackle the underlying social issue, right? That's one thing. Right. And when we think about trafficking, that has become something that has blown up on our in our country, because I think of the difficulties that countries close to us have experienced, and the influx of migrant persons coming from unstable countries and so on, especially when there's a language barrier, are vulnerable to exploitation in the form of human trafficking. So they may be lured or even forcibly taken and trafficked into sex work against their will. And that's the stories that, as you say, have been blazing on the front page. And it's not something that has happened recently, but it's the situation in Venezuela, I think, has exacerbated the situation, all right, for us here. Because, of course, we've had a huge influx of migrants. Now, is enough being done? So let's deal with facts here. I'm not dealing with allegations, innuendos, unsupported people, what people talking about open secrets and everybody know and whatever. I'm talking about what we do know. We do know that in 2020, there was a report prepared, the TIP report, they call it, Trafficking Persons Report, by the United States State Department, saying this is a problem. The problem with bringing people to justice is that there may be persons involved at this level, right? However they define that term, because we've heard all sorts of definitions and whatnot coming out, my view is that if in 2020 nothing was done with that information, that is a serious lapse on our part, because we passed the Trafficking Persons Act. We set up the counter-trafficking units. And I know people who work at the counter-trafficking units, and I've dealt with them, and I hear the stories, and I know what they do. But are they resourced well enough? And their work will obviously be stymied if you have interference at the level of quote-unquote senior government official, whatever, however you define that. All right. Now, what has happened now, though, that it has turned into is not me is you and is not you is them. And that conversation takes us nowhere. The question is, if in 2020 that information was put forward from a supposedly credible source, being the United States State Department, something ought to have been done to investigate and to address the issue. Why is it a 2022 report comes out saying almost the same thing, that there is this problem, and now in 2023 we have someone ordering an investigation, and you have people crawling out of the woodwork to say that they had information, what, more than 7 years ago? I mean, we have a tendency to turn everything in this country into a circus, and this is not a matter to be turned into a circus to score political points, to deflect blame or otherwise. This is a serious matter involving people's lives. I started reading that story you were talking about on the front page of The Guardian, and I could not finish it. I really couldn't finish reading the story. It was that sickening to me. And I think that something as serious that really affects disproportionately women and girls in the world, particularly women who find themselves being vulnerable as a result of poverty, as a result of economic strife and hardship in their own country, who leave their own country seeking a better life and are forced into this sort of a life, we ought not to trivialize that matter. by making it into a political he say, she say, them say, it was me, it was them, this one, no, that one, no. That takes us nowhere. I would like to believe that every single right-thinking person in this country would want to see, one, a properly resourced counter-trafficking unit that could assist with these investigations, and two, a comprehensive investigation into whether or not there is interference with investigations protecting any individual, whomever that person may be, that was identified in 2020, who may have been running interference with any investigation and using their position, which the U.S. describes as senior government official, whether that person be a person in law enforcement, in government, and wherever you may be, parliament, executive, judiciary, anywhere. Please, I want to see that dealt with, because that is a stain on our image as a country. If it is at that level, you have persons facilitating human trafficking. I want to point out that we have actually had police officers in this country charged for human trafficking as a result of the work of the counter-trafficking unit. And, you know, that is something that I think is a step in the right direction, because you will never be able to bring these types of crimes down if you have persons and the level of law enforcement involved in the commission of those offenses. So I would like to see those allegations investigated to the fullest extent possible, and free and fair investigations.
And I know that very well. We're way past the time that I'm supposed to have you on this morning, but
fine.
As we wrap up here this morning, I'd like you to speak to the people listening to us, the women, the young ladies, people who have daughters. What's some advice you'd give to them in this ever-changing environment, where the scales are tipped on all different sides based on the circumstances confronting each and every one? If you were to say, or if I'm asking you now, to give some advice to people who want to make it, want to be successful, what are some of the things that they should focus on?
Well, the first thing I would say is, which is, again, something that I think I've alluded to today, is that define success for yourself. Don't allow anybody to define to you what success should look like. Because what success is for me may not be what success is for you or for every other woman and girl in this country or in the world. I would say having confidence in yourself is truly one of the most important things. As women, we tend to have more challenges, I think, with that confidence, particularly because we are expected to, you know, we still have that philosophy and mindset in our society where women who look a certain way and, you know, all of that, it affects your self-confidence, your image. Physical attractiveness is always something that people play on a lot. So you have to build your confidence and feel secure in yourself. I would like not just to talk about the people who have daughters in terms of the women who have daughters, but the men. I don't think people understand and appreciate how important it is for a girl to have a male role model in her life, because that's what teaches a young woman about how a man should be and how a man should behave. Some of the most confident, well-balanced, successful women that I know, in my experience, and I observe it very well, they have very good relationships with their fathers, and their fathers are good husbands, good fathers, attentive fathers, emotionally available fathers. I think that's very important. It really does help with the development of young women. So you could have the mother who is saying, listen, do you know, grow up and make sure that you're educated and that no man can take advantage of you, etc., etc., etc. But when you have that stable home environment, and when I say stable, I don't mean that you have to stay married to each other and be married to each other in order to, you know, give your children a stable home environment. But if you are a father, whether you're in a relationship with the mother or not, do not underestimate the impact that you have in the lives of your daughters in raising well-balanced, emotionally stable and secure, and, you know, daughters who thrive in the world. So understand the role that you play as a father and a mother. Young girls, I would say, again, have confidence, define yourself, know what you want in your life and go after it. Don't let people make you believe that one role is better than the next. A short while ago, I did an interview with someone who was a similar thing, asking me like little facts about myself, and they asked me about my favorite book. And I tell people all the time, and it's a movie now, if you don't like to read, you can watch the movie, but the book Little Women has always been a favorite book of mine. And the reason for that is that it's a book about four sisters, and each one has a very distinctive personality. There's one who marries for love, but the person doesn't have, you know, the person she marries is not well off. So she struggles through life, making ends meet and being a mom and all that, but she loves being a mother. There's one who couldn't care less about love and marriage and children. She just wanted her career. She wanted to be a writer. There's one who's very artsy and wants to pursue, you know, a career in art and that kind of, and that book, to me, no one character in the book was seen as better than the other by the writer. And that is how life ought to be. Whether you choose, you know, whatever path you choose in life, if it is your path and it makes you happy, everybody should respect that, because there's no path is better than the other. However, education, and I will repeat what my mother taught me, because I think it has done me well in life. Education is the one thing that no one can take away from you. When you have an education, people change. People, feelings change, relationships change. Even your family's money. There are a lot of women who growing up now come from families that, you know, you have big business or your parents are successful and you have a lot of money. Those things can change very easily. You know, you never know what can happen. But when you have the ability to stand on your own two feet, whether you choose to enter the world of work or not, having that ability and having those capabilities is really something that no person could, no person, circumstance, nothing in life will take that away from you. And it will really always be the, I think, the guiding light that will take you through life in a way that will make you happy and make you feel fulfilled and content and make you a better professional, if that's what you choose to do, a better mom, a better wife, a better everything, because you'll know and you'll have that confidence in yourself. And it really does help your confidence when you pursue your dream and you get your education, regardless of what field that is in. So I know I talk a lot, and that's probably why I'm a lawyer.
Yeah.
But that's part of the advice that I would give.
This is where we're going to drop the curtain, Senator. Thank you so much. It's been a pretty interesting discussion. You know, normally when we have you on, it's to deal with some of these heavy, controversial bacchanalis issues and law and politics and all these things. It was refreshing to have a different perspective to some of these issues. And thank you for being our first guest this morning, this week, kicking off our discussions on issues related to International Women's Day. Thank you once again for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me again. I really appreciate it.
And that's where we drop the curtains, ladies and gentlemen. That, of course, opposition Senator Jayanti Lakshmi-Dayal, attorney at law, mother, businesswoman. You could tie all of those things into there. Beginning our discussions for the entire week, we will be having discussions focused on International Women's Day, women in our country, some of the challenges they're confronting, some of the issues that need to be resolved. Pros, the cons, the good, the bad, everything.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.